Welcome to 51%, the program about women. 51% is produced with the assistance of Russell Sage College in Troy, New York, the college for women of the world, in the world, and for the world. Your hosts are Dr. Jean Neff, president of the Sage Colleges, and Mary Darcy.
Welcome to 51%. I'm Mary Darcy.
And I'm Jean Neff. This week on the program,
if you see a woman director or a woman playwright in a season, it's an event. And a woman is not enough.
We'll take a trip off-Broadway for a look at a theater giving voice to women playwrights.
Then Joe Donahue talks with award-winning star of stage and screen Olympia Dukakis. And is it life imitating art or the other way around? You decide when we take you to Verona, Italy to meet the real-life Juliets.
Stay with us as we raise the curtain on a theatrical edition of 51%. New York City is the supermarket of theater, just aisle after aisle of all sorts of productions, everything from Broadway musicals to off-Broadway dramas to off-off-Broadway experimental comedies. And yet, with all this variety, it's still difficult to find work by women playwrights. So, what do you do when the store won't sell what you want? As 51%'s Greg Dahlman reports, you just have to make it yourself.
We're going to get along like a house on fire, because I have noticed taken in, registered, if you will, that the contents of this establishment is filled with two specimens of the female take or persuasion of women. Yes? I'm not afraid of the world.
It's a dark and snowy night on the outskirts of a small Minnesota town, and Brooklynite Vinnie Silverstein has just shown up, unannounced, at the home of sisters Rose and Ruby. And if that's not strange enough, their mother just died upstairs. What follows is a look at how love and family and personal history affect relationships and the way we see ourselves. It's all part of a recent production of the new play Saint Scarlet at the Ontological Theater in New York's Greenwich Village. The play is a production of Women's Expressive Theater. WET, as it's also known, is the result of a collaboration between two longtime friends, Victoria Pettibone and Sasha Eden. Pettibone says WET started taking shape in 1999.
It was Sasha who said, I love Joyce Carol Oates, I've always wanted to do this play, I Stand Before You Naked. And I read it and I said, great, let's do it. And we just did it. I mean, we didn't even question it. And at the same time, we said, well, while we're at it, we should form a company so that it's produced under a company and we can start to get donations. So we formed it nonprofit so we could raise money for the production. And there was no questions. We just went for it.
WET is now on its fifth production, still growing and advancing. Saint Scarlet features a script from up-and-coming playwright Julia Jordan, quality acting, and a detailed set. The New York Times called the production, quote, polished and professional in an encouraging review. And WET is making this happen in the sort of production that doesn't always hit these marks. Susan O'Connor plays the character Ruby in Saint Scarlet.
It's like off-Broadway quality in an off-off-Broadway house. So it's really nice to see people that are willing to put in the 23 and a half hours a day and just go, all right, we're going to do this, and we're just going to do it the best we can do it.
O'Connor says there's also something to how WET gets the job done. She says Pettibone and Eden have helped foster an environment in which people can take risks and fulfill their potential.
It's very nice to come into a group of people that just know you're going to succeed. They just look at you, and before you even open your mouth, they're like, this is going to be fantastic. You're just going to do so great. And you're like, oh, you're right, yeah, I'm going to do great. You're right, that sounds like a good plan.
People involved with WET say this atmosphere probably has something to do with the fact that women are setting the tone at the company. Hillary Cutter is WET's associate producer.
I work in other areas of production, including film production and commercial production, and I've always been in a very male-dominated group. And there's a different aura about it. A lot of times when there's more men involved, there just seems to be sort of a power issue. And I don't really feel that as much as working with WET. There's less of a power issue and less of a structure issue.
WET's producers are quick to point out the company is not about barring the door to men. Victoria Pettibone says even with a focus on providing interesting opportunities to women, men do contribute to the company's success. For example, Saint Scarlet's director, Chris Messina, is a man. Pettibone says they work to make sure WET's stated purpose doesn't get in the way of it actually attaining its goals.
there are certain theaters that do women's work but only do women's work and are sort of, they end up in a way being limited, and I think that they're very valuable, but I also think it's very valuable to do work in the mainstream that is still very, it celebrates women and doesn't just do the same old stereotypes.
Still, it can be a hard message to get out there when your name is Women's Expressive Theater. St. Scarlet's author, Julia Jordan, says she was concerned that having her work produced by WET might brand it as a quote-unquote women's play, until she met the company's producers.
It was very clear to me that it wasn't the typical. It wasn't exactly what I was afraid of. It was pretty genuine. They knew that it was harder for women to get produced, and it was harder for female actresses to get good roles, and that's where it came from.
Julia Jordan is on a hot streak this year. She's getting 4 plays produced in New York and 1 in Denver. That kind of success is rare for any playwright, but especially for a woman. According to the New York State Council on the Arts, during the 2001-2002 theater season, 17% of plays produced were written by women, and 16% were directed by women. Susan Jonas co-authored the report for the council. She says this underrepresentation of women in key theater positions is especially frustrating when you consider that many of the stage's recent big hits, like WIT and How I Learned to Drive, were written by women.
If you look at the programming at major institutions, and even mid-size institutions where those resources are, you will not see women. You will see almost no women. If you see a woman director or a woman playwright in a season, it's an event, and a woman is not enough.
Jonas says there are strategies women can take to change this. Women in the theater need to raise awareness, help mentor up-and-coming women, and lobby female philanthropists to apply pressure on theater companies. Victoria Pettibone says WET is doing its part by continuing to offer opportunities to women and continuing to stage quality productions.
I think we're willing to take even more risks. I mean, we've always been risk takers, but every year we sort of raise the bar a little bit.
Pettibone says WET isn't content to limit itself to the stage. She says the company is currently looking at the possibility of getting into film. For 51%, I'm Greg Dolman.
Know a performer, playwright, or theater lover who'd be interested in this week's show? Copies of all of our 51% programs are available by calling 1-800-323-9262.
Be sure to have the program number handy. Today's show is number 734.
Oscar-winning actress Olympia Dukakis has played some of the finest roles of stage and screen, but she's still best known as Moonstruck's matriarch, Rose Castorini.
Who's dead?
Nobody. Loretta's getting married.
Again?
Yeah.
Johnny Camilleri.
I don't like him.
You're not going to marry him, Cosmo. Do you love him, Loretta?
No.
Good. When you love him, they drive you crazy, because they know they can. But you like him?
Oh, yeah. You know, he's a sweet man, Ma. And this time I'm going to get married in the church and have a big reception.
And who's going to pay for that?
Pop. Mm.
What?
Father of the bride pays.
I have no money.
You're rich as Roosevelt. You're just cheap, Cosmo.
I won't pay for nothing.
Olympia Dukakis has been discovered many times on the long road to overnight stardom. She spoke with 51%'s Joe Donahue about the trip.
From her fame as the Oscar-winning actress in Moonstruck to her lauded role as Mrs. Madrigal, the landlord of indeterminate gender in Tales of the City, to being the cousin of presidential candidate Michael Dukakis, Olympia Dukakis has certainly captured the imagination of a broad audience. She is known for her straightforward talk, her lack of pretension, and her ongoing quest to explore ever more aspects of herself and her art. Olympia Dukakis's award-winning role in Moonstruck made her a household name. But before that, overnight success, came 28 years of hard work. It is work she outlines in her new book, Ask Me Again Tomorrow, a book she says she never intended to write.
Well, someone asked me to write it. At first I said no, but then they said, under what circumstances would you? And I thought, well, if I could deal with some of the issues that seems to have confounded me all my life, I would take another whack at it, and that's what happened.
What has confounded you all of your life?
Oh, just how to define myself, how to find my own authenticity, how to, you know, to, because I grew up with a lot of ethnic bias, gender bias, and that effort goes on.
I would like to get into that bias in a moment, but you were born in Lowell, Massachusetts,
right,
during the Depression.
Right.
In the book, you write extensively about your upbringing. How would you describe your childhood?
Well, it was volatile. It was during the Depression. I enjoyed tremendously play. I had a great love for play, which eventually became very much involved in sports. So there was that part of it. I was very surrounded by the Greek community in Lowell and my extended family and that kind of thing. Basically, what I did was I straddled two worlds, the Greek world and the what we call the American world, and I became a hyphenated person.
You do write about your relationship with both of your parents as well, and your relationship with your mother was very contentious and complicated.
It was.
Why?
Well, because she had a very clear idea of how I should be as a young Greek girl, and I was rebellious and willful because I was exposed to the American, shall we say, community as well, because of school, etc. She was very punitive about it, you know, very punishing and about it, and physically. And so we became very estranged, you know, it was really bad. Although, you know, as I grew up, I recognized that my mother's job was, you know, the Greek mothers are like the dogs of the house. They guard the house against dishonor. And that's what my mother felt her job was. And she also, as forceful as she was in this way, there were many ways in which with my father she was very compliant. And that bothered me tremendously, seeing that kind of relationship between them. And you would think that I would have gotten angry at my father, but actually I got angry at my mother, thinking, not wanting her to be that way, and determined that I would not be that way, and so I distanced myself even further from her.
Did your relationship with your mother improve?
Yes. I'm happy to say that it did. I know that there are people who've had terrible times with their parents and didn't have the opportunity to come full circle, but that's not what happened for me. I was very fortunate. My mother and I found each other, shall we say, and were able to be expressive and open with our love for each other.
You went to Sargent College initially and were originally looking to be a gym teacher.
That's right. Well, I loved sports. I loved all the competitiveness. I loved the aggressiveness of it. And
you were a fencing champion.
That's right. 3 years, the New England Junior fencing champion.
So when did those gym teacher plans go awry and you discovered the theater?
Well, what happened was I directed and wrote some show in college, and I was so happy doing it, I realized I didn't want to be a gym teacher. I wanted to do that, and so then I got but I had to get a job that paid me money so I could go back to school, and physical therapy paid very well, and I got a scholarship for the National Foundation of Infantile Paralysis, and I worked with them for 2 years after college doing different polio epidemics in four different locations in the country. At the time, the epidemics were still happening. The salt vaccine had not come out. It came out towards the very end of it, actually. So then I went back to graduate school and I studied.
What were those early acting classes like for you?
Oh, my God. It was like I come from a very, you know, formal background in sciences and lecturing. And these classes were very informal and emotional and volatile. And I thought, these people are nuts and crazy. And, of course, within 6 to 8 months, I was right there myself. And they were wonderful in the sense that I was the entanglement that I had within me started to unravel. And I began to have strong experiences publicly out front instead of hiding everything. That was great. But also it was overwhelming. So I ended up in therapy and drugs and a lot of other different things. But the acting also was very helpful. It helped me contain things and find a vessel, a way of acknowledging who I was, a safe way.
Is it difficult to teach acting?
Oh, sure. It's not easy. A lot of people say it's impossible. But I think that if you can... I mean, what's happened to me over the years, I've changed. I taught differently at the beginning, and it's something that I evolved slowly. And it's because I taught for 15 years at NYU in the graduate school, and now I teach. I go to different universities and for a week or so, or in the studios in New York.
Through the learning process of what you have learned and what you have taught, what have you learned about what makes you a good actress?
Being honest and not judgmental of myself and others, accepting of myself and accepting of others.
You mentioned a moment ago about the gender and ethnic bias that you face. When did you first realize that?
Oh, I guess the ethnic bias was about 9, gender bias maybe 10, 11.
How did that stand in your way professionally?
I couldn't get auditions because my name was such a strong ethnic name. If I had been willing to change my name, which I wasn't, to say something like Elizabeth Anderson, I could have had auditions. But and even today it goes on, you know. People are constantly being defined by their ethnicity.
But you don't face it as much, I'm assuming.
No, I still have it. Absolutely, it's
really?
There. Oh, sure. Oh, sure. You would think that by now, having done such varied parts as Moonstruck, Steel Magnolias, Dad, Holland's Opus, Tales of the City, it would be apparent that I am an actress capable of transformation. I'm what you would call a character actress, somebody who can play this character and that character. Still, the dominant commercial thing is ethnic, Greek or Jewish.
How do you get around it?
Well, if I like the part, I do it. If I don't like it, I don't do it. That's how I get around it.
Simple as that.
It's as simple as that.
Olympia Dukakis' new book is Ask Me Again Tomorrow. It is published by HarperCollins. For 51%, I'm Joe Donahue.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore.
That's amore, the theme from Olympia Dukakis' Oscar-winning romantic comedy, Moonstruck. One of the most romantic stories of all time was set not in Napoli, as the song says, but in Verona. In the 400 years since the publication of William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, the title characters have become famous worldwide for their eternal, albeit ill-fated, love. But in the city of Verona, Italy, it appears these star-crossed lovers are still very much alive. Each year, thousands of tourists visit the famous balcony in Verona where some believe a real Romeo may have wooed Juliet. But what's even more surprising is the number of letters written each year to Juliet. Thousands of letters are sent to Verona from around the globe telling Juliet their love stories and asking for advice. Most surprising of all, perhaps, is that those letters get answered. A team of secretaries, modern-day Juliets, answer the letters from lovers around the world. Radio Netherlands' Lara Kerner visited with them at Juliet's Club in Verona.
Sì, può mandare una lettera, basta che scriva Giulietta Verona.
This is from Russia, United States. This is from Hungary. Dear Juliet, I'm 16 years old. This year I traveled to Spain at holiday in Spain. It was a super holiday, but I am in love. I never forget him because he's intelligent, beautiful, and so lovely to me.
A holiday romance, basically.
Yes, we often receive letters after holiday.
Many of the letters are simply addressed to Juliet, Verona, Italy, but they always find their way to the club, where 10 modern-day Juliets diligently answer every single letter. but it all began with the 1937 Hollywood film Romeo and Juliet, as Eleanor Maskey explains.
Well, the first letters arrived in 1937 because someone saw a film by director Cukor and then thought there may be someone who answered the letters in Verona, and so they sent them to the tomb, and the guardian decided to answer, and then probably the news spread and people started writing more and more letters. Some girls started answering French letters, English letters, and so on. Now there are 10 of us. So by now, on average, we receive 4,000 letters a year from all over the world.
As well as the letters, thousands and thousands of tourists descend upon Verona every year to see the city where Romeo and Juliet played out their love story. But did the starstruck lovers really exist? Manuela Urba is a tourist guide in the town.
Between the end of the 13th century and the beginning of the 14th, in Verona there were two important families, the Capulets and the Montagues, and in Italian their names are Capuletti and Montecchi, and so we think probably Romeo and Juliet existed, lived in town. We don't have any particular documents about their life, so we don't know exactly when they died many other things about their story, but we think they were true.
Even though historians constantly debate the authenticity of the Romeo and Juliet story, the tourists who come to Verona every year are happy to believe that Romeo really did declare his love to Juliet while she looked on from her ivy-clad balcony.
And here we are in the courtyard. The balcony is a little bit high, and Juliet was there that night just standing and talking to herself about her new feelings. And we simply know that Romeo was hidden in the shade under the balcony, and then he began to answer to her words, and they decided to get married. They immediately realized they were in love.
In the courtyard below the balcony, there's a bronze statue of Juliet, her breast much shinier than the rest of her body. Apparently, if we stroke it, we'll be lucky in love.
I think these tourists who entered now are Italian, and I think they are going to touch. See? Yes, he did it.
Oh, they're all doing it now.
And when there are a lot of tourists, I mean, when there are groups, sometimes they are shy. They don't want to show that they are looking forward for love, and so they wait, but when the first one goes, then all the others just queue.
Right, they all follow like sheep. Yes.
Back at the Juliet Club, Giovanna has just finished answering a letter in German. But why, does she think, do people write to a figure that may never even have existed?
I think that Juliet has become a symbol of love because the story of Romeo and Juliet is very beautiful. Even if it is sad, it is a wonderful love story. Writing to Juliet is like writing to a myth, like writing also maybe to yourself. People write to Juliet very intimate feelings, maybe because she's not a real person. She does not judge. It's like writing to a friend.
A modern-day Juliet, speaking with Radio Netherlands' Lara Kerner in Verona, Italy. Well, that wraps up this week's edition of 51%, except, of course, for our women's words of wisdom. And this week, our quote comes from Broadway diva Bernadette Peters.
You've got to be original, because if you're like someone else, what do they need you for?
Broadway diva Bernadette Peters. Remember, if you have any words of wisdom you'd like to share with us, you can email us at 51% at wamc.org. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Mary Darcy.
And I'm Jean Neff. Join us next week for another edition of 51%.
Dr. Dr. Jean Neff is president of the Sage Colleges. Mary Darcy is producer of 51%. Production support comes from Russell Sage College in Troy, New York, the college for women of the world, in the world, and for the world. 51% is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.